to keep the peace, to pioneer the future. This is the mission of your AAF. The Army Air Forces, in cooperation with the American Broadcasting Company, presents Your AAF, a weekly report to the American people on its continuing operation throughout the world today and its adventures in research, which are pioneering for your better world tomorrow. Soldier Orchestra of the AAF takes to the air with a carefully considered report. Love is sweeping the country. Story of the breathing head. Behind the thrilling record of America's progress in the air is many a little known story of research pioneering, written by unsung soldiers of science. For one of the most interesting of these stories, we take you now by Army wire recorder to Wright Field. Go ahead, Captain Howard Finch.
This is your AAF reporter, Captain Howard Finch, broadcasting from the Oxygen Test Unit of the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Laboratory at headquarters, Air Technical Service Command, Wright Field, near Dayton, Ohio, the birthplace of aviation. Within a stone's throw of this building, the Wright brothers developed their first airplane. And in this laboratory, scientists and technicians of aviation medicine have developed hundreds of aids to health, safety, and efficiency in the air. The oxygen test unit has been a veritable beehive during the war, and as I talk, I'm surrounded by an amazing assortment of odd-looking machines, decompression chambers, oxygen tanks, and gadgets of every description. This, then, is really a broadcast from a room of the future. The discoveries and tests made here today will regulate the health and safety of those who fly tomorrow. I've mentioned that there are all sorts of queer gadgets here that the unit uses for experimental purposes. And one in particular that I'm standing before now is a Frankensteinish affair, fantastically like a human head. As a matter of fact, that's almost what it is, and it's called the breathing head. That's right, the breathing head, so called by the lab technicians because that's exactly what it does. When Army Air Force's flyers first began high-altitude bombing missions over Germany, they found that their oxygen masks became encrusted with ice at the inspiratory ports in the mask so that oxygen could not reach the lungs. Here, then, was a situation that, if not soon corrected, would have cost the lives of many of our flyers. So, the problem was placed right where it belonged, squarely in the lap of the Aeromedical Laboratory at Wright Field. And the technicians started out to do something about it. Now, to tell you what they did first is Master Sergeant James W. Groshong of the Aeromedical Laboratory.
First, it was necessary to find out just why the mask froze. That was easy. The human breath is warm and moist, and in the extreme cold encountered at high altitudes, the breath condensed to moisture and then froze. More breathing made more moisture and more ice. The problem was finally brought to its solution when improvements to the mask were made. And that's where this breathing head comes in. Once an improvement was made, there was no way to check its effectiveness under varying conditions. It was obviously impossible to ask combat flyers to test them. They had other things to do, and to place a man in a chamber and leave him there a few days was not at all satisfactory, to say the least. So, engineers at this laboratory designed the breathing head to replace human guinea pigs, and in conjunction with the General Electric Company, designed the head before us.
Thank you, Master Sergeant Groshong. And now let's inspect this weird device. The head is about a foot and a half high and sits on a little Bakelite pedestal staring off into space. And, by the way, as you touch it, it even feels lifelike. His lungs, as you might term them, operate on a bellows principle, and the head can be made to breathe easily or heavily as desired for purposes of the test. A heater and humidifier supply the heat and moisture of the breath to make it lifelike, and it even wears a wig for simulating human hair bulk and for accurate fitting of the headgear. All in all, the breathing head, which can even smoke a cigarette for you, is a darn good soldier. He never lays down on the job, and through him, the lives of thousands of our airmen were spared during the war. So, just before we say goodbye to him, let's bring our microphone right up close to him and listen to the rubber, lifelike head as it actually breathes. And now, suppose we increase his breathing a little. Well, that's about all the time we have for our visit today to this world of tomorrow. The room full of amazing machines and gadgets and the oxygen test unit of the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Laboratory at headquarters of the Air Technical Service Command at Wright Field, Ohio. We brought you a story and a description of the breathing head. And we return you now to your AAF in New York.
With censorship a thing of the past and military security no longer a necessity, it's the air crew giving out with I Don't Care Who Knows It.
Nothing, honey, child.
Never.
Absolutely.
Hey.
Behind the scenes on A Flight into a Hurricane. To chart the course of stormy weather is the mission of a little band of intrepid airmen attached to the Caribbean wing of the Air Transport Command. For their story, we take you by Army wire recorder to Morrison Field.
This is your AAF radio report at Morrison Field, the Army Air Force's Air Transport Command base at West Palm Beach, Florida. We're going to take you behind the scenes on a hurricane flight. So we set up our wire recorder in the busy weather office, teletypes going, phones ringing. We're right on the edge of the landing strip. There's a storm brewing over the Caribbean now, and one of the first weather reconnaissance squadron crews has been ordered out to fly into it and record weather data. That's their plane you hear warming up in the background, along with the APC Caribbean Wing cargo planes. Meet the hurricane crew.
First Lieutenant Bertram H. Martins of San Francisco. A pilot.
Navigator, First Lieutenant Redding, W. Bunning, Dunbar, PA.
Weather observer, Second Lieutenant Bernard J. Kaplan, New York City.
Co-pilot, Second Lieutenant Walter E. Olson, Proctor, Minnesota.
Radio operator, Staff Sergeant Charles Filo, Captain, Task Force Denver.
Engineer, Staff Sergeant Clarence H. Lyman, Manchester, New Hampshire.
And that's the crew, complete with flight bags, parachutes, and Maywet. Lieutenant Martins, how long do you fellas stay out on these hurricane flights?
We make two flights a day from the nearest air base until the storm gets over land. After that, the ground stations send in their observations. Actually, we're like a flying weather station. While in flight, we radio our weather reports to the Army Hurricane Control Officer in Miami every 15 minutes. It's like having a weather station placed a few miles in the Caribbean and Atlantic.
Well, just how do you know where to go searching for these storms?
Well, our planes average two reconnaissance flights a day. Headquarters puts all our reports together and figures out where the storm will hit next and orders us out accordingly. Headquarters calls us on a direct line from Miami, and here, we'll show you how it's done. Cast in on the loudspeaker and make like the major.
Hey, Morrison Field.
This is Morrison Field. Martin speaking.
Okay, Morrison, it looks like there's rotten weather out there. Check the region. It's 17 degrees north, 85 degrees west.
Okay, Cap. Well, that's the information we got last night, which is why we're taking off this morning. Now we'll fly right into the center of the storm, record its intensity, the pressure, and the winds. If it's a hurricane, headquarters alerts everyone concerned.
Were you fellas in that big whopper of a hurricane we just had out here?
In it? Kepler discovered it on one of our routine flights.
Yeah, I couldn't miss it. For 4 days out there, all our planes and crew were checking on it in every direction, with the wind blowing as high as 150 miles an hour.
150?
That's right. It was rough flying. With two at the controls, the plane was barely manageable. Of course, all our equipment was strapped in, and so were we. We couldn't hang on otherwise. But flying into storms is routine work for us. We've flown in every one this year. And by the way, sorry, but it's time for us to check out. Let's go, fellas.
There they go, out to their B-25. We'll follow them outside. And while they're on their way to the plane, I'd like to clear up one thing for them. The men of the 1st Weather Reconnaissance Squadron don't like to be called daredevils. They don't fly into storms for the thrill of it. They have a very grave reason. Because of flights like theirs, civilian and military evacuate personnel from hurricane areas. Farmers protect their crops. Civil airlines move their planes to safer places. Commercial flights stay away from turbulent areas. Everyone is alerted in advance. But more than that, the weather research they are doing today will make civil aviation of tomorrow even safer than it is. The crew's in the plane now. They're waving. The plane is turning. And they're taking off the field. So long, fellas. Happy hurricane hunting. This is your AAF radio reporter at Morrison Field, the Air Transport Command's Caribbean Wing Base, returning you to New York City.
This is your AAF, the official program of the Army Air Force. Faster than any plane, radio spans the earth with news and stories and music. This program, recorded by the Armed Forces Radio Service, is beamed to your GI overseas, wherever he may find himself tonight. To him and to you, Sergeant Bob Carroll speeds a song, something the guys will be singing from Tokyo to Tulsa, from Bombay to Brooklyn. Listen to me, escúchame. Have gone in this war, they have hungered for many things, for home, for loved ones, for the simple necessities of life itself. But one thing our men have never gone without has been religion, the chance to worship the God of their own choice, to find spiritual guidance in their loneliest, darkest hours. For a story as inspirational as any that has come out of this war, we take you by Army wire recorder to Kunming, China. This is your AAF reporter in Kunming, China. The bell you hear is that of St. Charles Chapel, where we have our microphone located. A chapel which, to our knowledge, is the only one of its kind in the Orient. Everything to the last detail was made possible by the ingenuity of GIs attached to the 301st Air Depot. St. Charles Chapel and its congregation are led by a Belgian-born chaplain, Father Charles L. Mayus. Father Mayus, where did you resurrect the material for the structure of your chapel?
Oh, that was a former hospital tent.
It appears to me that your pulpit vaguely resembles the nose from a P-40.
Yes, that's true. Look, you can readily see the prominent white teeth of the shark's mouth, symbolic of the famous flying tigers. I might add that the name, you see over there, the name of the plane was the Little Flower, a common appellation given to St. Teresa.
Yes, I noticed a picture enshrined in the chapel.
Oh, incidentally, the boys made that from the rear tire of a salvaged P-51. Oh, the men of all the departments of the 301st Air Depot poured in ideas and contributions.
I couldn't help but notice the decorative effect of the ceiling as I walked in. It looks like parachute material to me.
Well, that's what it is. See, the parachute repair shop brought in a salvaged blue supply chute to drape our tent with as a sanctuary.
I imagine you had some dealings with the ordnance department for your tabernacle idea. Am I right?
Oh, yes. They insisted on making it. And they did so. Now, with a truck headlight, an auxiliary gasoline tank, and a couple of propeller ball bearings and gears. And then the tabernacle was sprayed in gold by the men from the paint shop.
It appears to me that kneeling facilities are much more comfortable than many of the churches I've attended in the States.
Believe it or not, that was solved by using discarded rubber wing defrosters. Now look at the chairs. They're made from empty bomb racks turned upside down. That was all given to us by the boys in the chemicals department. Oh, I'd like to give credit to the medics in the medical department for the fine altar linen and the other paraphernalia they so generously contributed.
Where did the red light shining above the altar come from?
Oh, that happens to be the light, let's see, from the left wing tip of a P-38. That was given to us by the electrician. Now, you can't imagine the store of material that was brought in by the GIs from their so-called junkyards. Take those flower vases you see over there. They were made from engine cylinders. And then that curtain effect on the altar is really a number of machine gun belt conveyors. They're made of stainless steel.
Speaking of junkyards, that reminds me, the standing joke around here is that you seem to be a refugee from a junk pile yourself. How about an explanation?
Oh, well, coming over the Burma Road, our truck kind of took a shortcut, and they had me in the hospital. You know, a gold bricking, you know? So that's where the fellows picked me up, to be their padre.
Well, we're glad you're back in good shape again, Father. I noticed as I came in the entrance the brilliance of your holy water container. Where in the world did you pick that up?
The holy... Oh, yes. That is an upturned reflector from a P-51. And while I'm at it, I might explain that the flower vase you see in front of the Blessed Virgin Mary, that is the aluminum tip of a discarded propeller. And the shrine itself, it's made of Bombay doors from a B-24. I'd like to give credit at this point to our Jewish boys. They designed those two beautiful plexiglass adoring angels. You see them next to the tabernacle? And also to our Protestant friends who cut them out.
Father, do you mean to say that all this was made possible by the GIs?
Oh, yes, that's true. Now, the tireless effort exerted by our men... That is a real credit to the American GI ingenuity. Those boys, they take great pride in their accomplishments. Well, you can readily see why.
But thank you, Father Mayes. We have been speaking from St. Charles Chapel at the Army Airfield in Kunming, China. A chapel erected entirely by the efforts of GIs from the 301st Air Depot. To our knowledge, the only one of its kind in this theater. This is your AAF reporter, Corporal J. Milner, returning you to the United States.
Out of the wreckage and turmoil of war, out of the fires of a world laid waste, man's faith in his God survives stronger than ever. And this faith is man's hope, for with it he will yet see the day when all men truly live as brothers, knowing peace and tolerance and understanding in one world. Now, from the singing voices of the AAF, it's a salute to every American city and a medley from a picture that cheered for one. Meet me in St. Louis. week, a long gray line of fighting ships steamed into New York Harbor. The Enterprise, the Midway, the mighty Missouri. The great battleships, carriers, cruisers, and destroyers that fought the decisive battles in our sea war across the world. As New York booms its welcome to the men in Navy blue, as a grateful nation prepares to pay its homage on Navy Day, the men of the Army Air Forces salute their fighting brothers, offer their thanks for a fighting record second to none, and for the cooperation that never failed in war and will always continue in peace. To keep the peace, to pioneer the future, this is your AAF. You have been listening to the official program of the Army Air Forces. The All-Soldier Orchestra was conducted by Master Sergeant Felix Blatkin. The program produced and directed by Staff Sergeant Ian Martin. And your announcer, Corporal Larry Thompson.
This is the American Broadcasting Company. This is the American Broadcasting Company.